This is The Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. On this week's episode, Bill and Phil grapple with the questions of why Iran launched roughly 300 missiles at Israel, and whether Trump's trials will matter come November. Now let's go to the lab.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Politics Lab. My name is Phil Barker, and I'm a professor of political science at Keene State College. And I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Bill Muck, who's a professor of political science at North Central College. Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm doing great. Good morning, Phil. We're taping again in the morning because we found that we're sharper in the morning. We're too sleepy in the afternoon now.
I like this groove. We started a couple of weeks ago, we did this because we had scheduling conflicts in the evening. But now, podcasting with a cup of coffee in the morning is pretty nice.
It is pretty good. It is pretty good. And especially at this time of the academic year, where we're getting close, couple weeks left in the semester, students are checked out. They are tired. You can sort of feel the exhaustion, but also the energy of getting close to the end. But it doesn't translate into a lot of intellectual, great discourse in the classroom anymore.
No, and the faculty are also exhausted at this point and looking forward towards the end. So, yeah, just another week and a half and we're there, Bill.
It is. We are getting close. Well, we should tell our listeners, some of our old listeners, new listeners, we're going to try something slightly different today. We're going to go a little bit shorter in this episode. Isn't that right, Phil? A little shorter. We're thinking about new ways to present the podcast and maybe some other alternatives outside of the podcast. So we're just going to try a few new things and we hope people like them.
I'm sure they will, Bill.
Absolutely. So that's good. All right. Well, you want to remind everybody how they can stay connected?
Yeah. So you can find us, as usual, at thepoliticslab.com. You can find all of our episodes there. And as is always the case, you can find, if you go to that website, click on them, for each episode, we have articles that are relevant to the topics we talked about. So you can find all of that information about Bill and I at thepoliticslab.com.
That is fantastic. All right, Phil, our first question for the day is, why did Iran launch 300 missiles at Israel? What's going on here? What's happening? What do we need to know?
Yeah, so, this was earlier this week. I'm sure people have seen in the news. Iran launched 300 missiles, a lot of missiles. So it's a combination of missiles and drones at Israel. This was in response to wasn't quite as prominent in the news, which was a week or so prior to that, Israel had attacked an Iranian consulate in Damascus and had killed a number of top Iranian generals. So this is in response to that. But this is also pretty significant and really unprecedented. So Iran and Israel don't like each other. They haven't liked each other for, a number of decades now. But despite all of that, they haven't come to sort of direct blows like this. And so, in the midst of all the other turmoil in the Middle East, it has never before happened that Iran has attacked Israeli soil directly. And so now the question turns to, what is this? And I think this is the thing we can wrestle with here today, which is, what's the significance of this? Just how dangerous is this moment? Where do we go from here? Is there sort of any positive outcome to this? And I think there's a lot that we can dig into here. And there's a lot that political science has to say about this. I mean, I think about sort of, kind of core realist ideas about, security and standoffs and how these countries might respond. But I don't know, where do you want to start with this? There's a lot we can dig into with this topic. We can talk about sort of what led to this. We can talk about sort of who's at fault. We can talk about potential outcomes of this. Is there a part of the story that's kind of captured that you've been found yourself thinking about more this week than others?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the global reaction has been kind of fascinating in terms of when the Iranian attack occurred, and there were many who felt like there was lots of conversation beforehand how it was going to happen, does this mean that the Middle East is going to blow up in war? And I think there's the potential, right? And that's why we will talk about it, the possibility of escalation. But I think it's useful maybe to begin and think about the attacks themselves, like what Israel did and what message that sent, and then Iran's response and what message that is sending. Because I think, as you suggested, there's really important messaging going on here, and there are rules that both have kind of broken the sort of common understanding of how the two have dealt with each other and what all of that means. And so maybe start with Israel. And I think this isn't maybe getting as much attention as it should be. So April 1st, Israel carries out this attack against an Iranian consulate in Syria, in the city of Damascus, right? So think about, this is a diplomatic office 13 people were killed, including some top-ranking generals. Now, Israel has not acknowledged that they've done this, but I think the evidence is pretty clear that they were behind it. To me, this feels like a pretty provocative attack.
Yeah, I just want to jump in because I don't know that listeners necessarily sort of understand the significance of this. So, you know, this is a consulate. So people talk about like diplomatic immunity and the importance of embassies and whatnot. And embassies have been like, you know, when people talk about international law and sort of understandings of how countries deal with each other, the role of diplomacy and embassies goes back a long time. And this is kind of one of in the international arena, one of the kind of unbreakable rules. And so this was a consulate, so it wasn't the embassy itself, but it's the building next door. And it has the same sort of international legal protections that an embassy does. So it is hands off. This is where, you know, just we talked a little bit about this last week with the Mexico-Ecuador thing. But, you know, this is why it was such a huge deal when the American embassy in Iran was stormed. It's like, this is a really big deal. And so for Israel to directly target it is, I mean, this is more than just targeting generals in a foreign country. It is, you know, a violation of one of the core laws, core principles of like international law and diplomacy. So I think it's important to begin with just how big of a deal it is that Israel decided to strike this building.
And I think that's an important point because oftentimes we hear about these strikes in, you know, at some compound, you know, that there's an Iranian general in Syria or elsewhere, right? No, you're right. This is in the city. This is in a formal diplomatic building. Big, big, big deal. And for Iran, there had to be a response, right? So if you're Iran thinking about this, you've got to do something. Otherwise, you will face tremendous domestic pressure for letting Israel attack you and not responding. So time goes by and there's lots of discussion about how Iran is going to respond and what that's going to look like. And that response is really fascinating as well. So this last Saturday, Iran launches this attack, but it's not as if the missiles just started raining down. They began with the drones. So the first wave were these drones that are relatively slow, and it's easy to detect them. And so I think a lot of people are speculating that this was Iran signaling, hey, more things are coming, but we don't want to fully surprise you. And to me, that's important as we think about these signaling. So Iran is certainly escalating the relationship by directly targeting Israel. But I think they're calibrating, saying, hey, you escalated by targeting our consulate, right? So we have to think about how we respond proportionately, but also sending a signal that this was inappropriate. So they begin with those drones that are sort of slowly coming, which allows Israel, the United States, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and I think it's important to note that there were a bunch of Arab countries who also helped in Israel's defense here. And then the cruise missiles and then the ballistic missiles came, and there were, you know, roughly 300 of them, but Israel was able to shoot down, I think, all of them. So there was only one girl who was hurt, and I think that was just by some, you know, collateral part of a missile or shrapnel that hurt them. So Israel is able to fully defend against this attack, so, which I think sort of that dynamic and the calibration of both sides is sort of interesting to me as we think about that.
Yeah, it's really, I think it's important to sort of recognize that on one hand, I mean, the I don't know, the choreography of all of this is kind of understood. I think it's important to recognize both that this is the classic example of actors being rational, right? Like Iran is like, we have to do something, but we don't want to be, you know, we don't want to be overly provocative. We still want to avoid war, all of this stuff. And so there's lots of calculating going on and there's a lot of caution going on, but it's also at the same time, like you said, Iran can't not do anything. I think the flip side is, you know, again, just to put yourself in their shoes, right? If Iran had blown up an American embassy or consulate in London, right? Like we would 100% you can't not respond to that. And so this is, you know, it's understandable that they're trying to respond, but they're trying to be cautious. And so I think one part is it's important for people when you're just watching on the news, you see these exchanges and it's easy to miss all the intentionality and caution and again, the choreography behind it. The other part is that when you realize all of that's going on, there's a danger in assuming that, okay, nobody wants war to happen. They're all being cautious. War won't happen. And I think that's also the false assumption, because even with all of this choreography, There are mistakes, there are misinterpretations. And this is where we talk about, this is kind of, you know, kind of classic security dilemma type stuff, which is like, Israel does this, Iran feels the need to respond. You know, Iran can't just not act when Israel attacks an Iranian consulate. But now they've played their, you know, Iran has played their part, and now you're Israel and you're sitting here, and it never before has Iran attacked Israeli territory directly. And now they have, they've launched 300 missiles. And again, flip it around, right?
Yeah.
If Iran launched 300, you know, even if they did it intentionally, slowly, and like you were saying, I think it's, you're exactly right. People pointed out Iran did not use their fastest or best missiles in this process. Like, it was meant to allow, you know, Israel to respond in a way that, that didn't do as much damage. But again, if Iran did that to the United States, even in a way that was allowed us to defend ourselves, we would not just say, well, now we're done, right? And so every step of this, there's feels there's this need to respond. And that's where I don't know how we get out of this cycle. I mean, this is where all Israeli allies, including the United States, have basically come out and said, look, Israel, this was great. Like, you did enough by basically shooting all of these down, showing how superior your defenses are. You've squashed Iran's, you know, attack. And so that's good enough. And I think everyone's trying to get this to basically end here. But Netanyahu's not really an end it here kind of guy, I don't think. So, but how do you see this sort of playing out?
Well, this is a really great question, right? Because so the question is, as you noted, does it stop here? And so Biden and the UK and everybody else is saying, as you noted, good job, call it a day. Even Iran, as the attack was going out, they put out some tweets saying, basically, we consider this situation ended, right? So Iran is trying to say, we had to respond, we responded, let's all call it a day. If you're Israel, can you do that? Can you frame it as our defense makes it, done? Or is there going to be some sort of response? And then does it have to be an escalation, or can you de-escalate it? Can you go back to the old ways? How you engaged with Iran, which would be more like a cyber attack, going after more informal organization, proxy forces, right? So there would be ways to respond that would de-escalate, but would still be a response, but it doesn't give you that political flash that a very visible response will be. And it also then raises this question about Netanyahu, the prime minister, and what are his political prospects? What is he looking like? And as an individual, how is he going to use this response to help himself? Because he's in a really precarious political position, and it might be that accelerating an incident with Iran could actually be good for him, right? And you sent me an article that talked about how by responding the way Iran did, they really gave Netanyahu a chance to kind of recycle his political career, right? Because nobody's talking about Gaza right now, right? For a week or so, we've all switched our focus. And he was under tremendous pressure. So he may have an interest in continuing this with Iran, because it shifts the conversation away from a bad topic to one that is much more politically positive for him. I think all of that is really interesting to think about as well.
Well, let's dig into that, because I think this is really fascinating, because there's a lot of different angles to this. One of which is, so Netanyahu, you know, is this kind of hardline, you know, prime minister of Israel, has been in place for a long time. And there are people who talked about even the original attack that Hamas did on Israel sort of gave Netanyahu a lifeline in some ways. Like, it challenged him, but it also, you know, puts him on this war stance, and you have rally around the flag and all of that stuff. But he had been facing increasing pressure, certainly internationally, and you know, increasing strain with their longest, strongest ally, the U.S., and increasing pressure at home. And so this attack from Iran, so the whole idea of the rally around the flag effect is that when this happens, like, people tend to, you know, rally around their country. So when Iran launches all these attacks at Israel, it's again, you know, think post September 11th after, you know, George Bush, this huge surge in support and whatnot. So he has that lifeline, but then it also provides him a lifeline in how to deal internationally with things, because, you know, so it becomes this sort of, this card he can play. If the U.S. is continuing, you know, pushing, you've got to rein in what you're doing in in Gaza, there's now this also, you know, this threat of Iran. And one of the articles that, that you and I were, you know, sharing back and forth talked about how, like, this is a card that he can now play with, you know, Biden or the U.S. or other allies, which is to say, look, I will end it here. I won't respond to Iran, but I will only do that essentially if you, you know, continue to support us in Gaza. So it's an opportunity for him, but it also brings into question that, or it helps sort of come around to this discussion of rationality, and what is rational for Israel may not necessarily be the same as what's rational for Netanyahu. So this is similar to the question with Putin and Russia, right? Where, like, stuff that Russia is doing is not good for Russia, even if it might be good at extending Vladimir Putin's term in office, right? Yes. And so you have a similar dynamic playing out here with Netanyahu in Israel, and that is potentially, like, when you're thinking about the fact that what's good for Netanyahu isn't necessarily what's good for the world or for the Middle East is a concerning situation. So I mean, first of all, I guess respond to any of that you want. But I also think we should dig into a little bit about, like, will Netanyahu respond or how will he respond here?
Well, I think, as you were highlighting here, it increases the incentive for Netanyahu to be a risk taker. So a lot of times we talk about this on the podcast, like, when are leaders willing to take risks? And the political place he finds himself may encourage him to be a bit more aggressive than he might be if he was in a safe political position, right? So the downside for escalating with Iran is pretty minimal. He's already hated internationally, right? He's isolated. He hasn't been listening to Biden for a long time, right? So on Gaza, Biden has been putting a tremendous amount of pressure on Netanyahu to say, hey, move to a ceasefire. Do not invade Rafah, right? We don't want this to happen. And Netanyahu's like, nah, we're not going to do that, right? I'm not going to listen to you. So he has already demonstrated an indifference to some of international opinion, and particularly to his closest ally, the United States. And, you know, shifting the conversation towards Iran, all of that, as you note, is not a rational, I don't believe it's a rational course of action for Israel, but it could be very, very rational and pay real dividends for Netanyahu as a prime minister, where suddenly, you know, it's a rally around the flag effect. I think there's a lot of reasons why he might do so. I think he's facing a really a complicated choice, either escalate or de-escalate, but either of them have to serve his own political interest.
Well, an escalation is, I mean, Israel's in a tough place, right? Like, escalation with Iran is like, you know, opening a second, starting a second war while you're already, you know, it seems like, I don't know how he doesn't respond, how Israel doesn't respond to this, but it's certainly, this is again where I think Israel doesn't want a war with Iran, but maybe Netanyahu does. That's a difficult thing.
Well, and then the other question on the flip side is, does Iran want a war with Israel? And I think it's very similar to, like, World War One, where neither side really, really wants a war. But when you start escalating and these scenarios keep playing out, you can stumble into a war where you become trapped by the circumstances.
So let's talk about that for a second. Let's talk about this from Iran's perspective, which is this, if they don't like Israel and they don't like Netanyahu, maybe they do like Netanyahu in that they hate him and he provides a good, you know, enemy for them to point at, and that helps keep their regime in place. But if you don't like Netanyahu, then and this actually benefits him in some ways. The question becomes then, did Iran overplay their hand? And so I come back around to, like, you know, there's no doubt that the Israeli attack on an Iranian consulate is a big, big, big deal. But should Iran have, should they have played this in a different way? Should they have responded with an attack on a consulate somewhere, like, sort of a proportionate? Was this a proportionate response, or did this in some way, even with all of their signaling, even with all of their, we're going to send our drones first, is this still too much of an escalation from Iran's standpoint?
It's really interesting, because I think maybe, but we see a similar dynamic playing out Iran that we're seeing in Netanyahu. So Iran is willing to take more risks now after the consulate attack, where beforehand, if Israel hadn't targeted the diplomatic facility, Iran probably doesn't directly target Israel. And I think that's so important. Like, this is the first time that Iran has directly targeted the Israeli territory. So it's an escalation, but they felt like they had to, which may force Israel's hand, right? So it's entirely possible that they escalated too great. It was too big of a jump. But they're in a similar position. Like, what do we got to lose, right? We are also diplomatically isolated. We're also angry what's going on in Gaza. The United States and the world community has a gazillion sanctions on us. The Iran nuclear deal has failed. So there's a whole lot of reasons for why Israel may also be in a position to say, hey, we're willing, I'm sorry, Iran may be in the same position to gamble. And again, that's really, really dangerous because when both sides have an interest in taking more risks, that's how you stumble into a war, even if either party doesn't necessarily want that outcome.
Yeah. So, and that's where, like, I, you know, people have pointed to, like, the U.S. attack on the Iranian general under when Trump was in,
Soleimani,
in office.
And, yes,
and, yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And Iran responded to that. And I think most Americans tend to think sort of that was the end of it. But, like, people who really follow Iranian, you know, politics in U.S. point out that those were sort of the big ones. But there has been this ongoing kind of back and forth between the U.S. and Iranian proxies basically ever since. So it like kind of, you know, it sort of re, I don't know, it I don't know, kind of provides a, recalibrates this relationship in a way. As you were talking, my political science brain sort of kicks in here. And I think about, like, we as political scientists are really good at explaining how, you know, why the situation happens and why it's sort of problematic. So we talk about, you know, in the international arena, there's no world government to enforce things. And so, you know, you have all these sovereign countries, they're all rational. So Iran and Israel have no one to count on other than themselves, right? Like you have your own, you know, you're responsible for your own security. And in that situation, it is totally understandable why they can't or why they have a hard time trusting each other, why Israel sees a threat from Iran, why Iran sees a threat from Israel. And as a result, again, it's easy to see why, you know, Israel, in response to Iran's proxies, you know, for years attacking Israel, Israel sees this opportunity to take out a general, they do so. Iran sees that as a threat and they have to respond. Israel sees Iran's attack as a threat and they have to respond. And so it's easy to sort of point out how this spirals. Do we have any answers about how we end that? Like how, like this is like a, it feels like a train wreck. You can see happening, right? It's understandable why it's happening. We can see where it's going, but like how, what are the solutions for stopping the train before it goes, you know, off the tracks here?
So if we look at history, when you've had these moments of security dilemma dynamics, usually, at least my sense of history, what prevents them from spiraling is agents, is actors, right? In those moments who step back and say, we're not going to do this, right? We are going to try to avoid escalation. And sometimes history, we've seen those important people. You and I talk at length about the Cuban Missile Crisis and the role that Kennedy and Khrushchev played in saying, like, no. We see where this ends and we are going to intentionally, maybe even embrace a little political risk to avoid that. At the same time, we can see lots of actors throughout history who just run right through that and are indifferent to it, and it usually ends up in a bad place. The one good thing I will say about all of this is if we know anything about Biden and the Biden administration, they are attentive to avoiding escalation. Whether we're talking about Ukraine, where I think the Biden administration has been very, very careful to keep this in a local conflict. I think Biden has spent, and the Secretary of State have spent a lot of time in Israel and Gaza trying to localize this. So if there's as an international actor who's good at that, I think Biden is very, very relevant. The question is, will Netanyahu listen to him? Right. So it certainly is not inevitable that this spirals. And I tend to think it's more likely not to spiral than it is to. But some of that will come back to agency and actors making good choices. I don't know. What do you think? Yeah. Do you think that the actors in this scenario are up to the challenge?
I was grimacing while you were talking about the importance of agency because of Netanyahu and Iran, right? Like these are not like people that you have a whole lot of faith in when you're, but to come back around to it, like the fact that Iran responded, but signaled and sort of maybe did this in a, like there's hope there in that they're even, you know, there's way they are sending the message, even if Netanyahu blows through it, Iran is clearly, you know, wanting to send this message that they're not looking at this moment to escalate it. So that is, I think, positive. No, I think you're right. I mean, whether it's the Cuban Missile Crisis or whether we talk about the importance of you know, Gorbachev at the end of the Cold War, like individuals matter, right? It is they're the ones who are able to look at the situation, see the danger, and come up with solutions. And You just have to hope that either, you know, Netanyahu and Iranian leaders are wise enough to see that, or that the international community can put enough pressure on them to do that. Which takes me to another question, which is, and we should move on here pretty quickly, but is there a response to this? So this you know, very close relationship between the U.S. and Israel has been, Biden came out and basically said, like, we will support Israel no matter what, but also they should be careful how they respond. Your threats are diminished when you start off by saying we will support you no matter what. Right. But that relationship has been frayed. Right. But is there anything that Netanyahu or Israel can do in this moment that would break that relationship, or that would lead the U.S. to actually, you know, withdraw their support from Israel, or, you know, to make not even withdraw their support, but to make a real difference in how the U.S. approaches Israel?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I don't think so on the Iran-Israel issue. I do think there's the potential for the Gaza-Israel issue for the United States, or I should say the Biden administration, to pull support from the Netanyahu government, right? I don't think the United States would ever say we're leaving Israel, but I think Biden could try to thread that needle by saying we no longer believe that Netanyahu has the best interest of Israel at stake, and we are going to shift our policy accordingly and maybe put some limits on weapons that are going there. I could see that kind of scenario, but I think that it would be an earthquake for the United States to say we are no longer supporting Israel. Long term, that's a very different conversation. But I think in the short term, thinking about this, I think it's less likely.
It does feel like we are at one of those sort of key moments as Israeli leaders are meeting to decide how to respond. Like, this is a decision that could make, you know, could be the beginning of a major war, or it could be like this, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis moment where we're able to pull back. It'll be hopefully the right decisions are made there.
And we will probably know more next week, right? We'll have some more data, kind of see how Israel responding, and then we can think about it then.
Next week's opening topic is how do we feel about World War III?
Right.
Hopefully that's not the case. So let's you want to shift gears?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So the other big question we want to wrestle with today is based around the fact that Donald Trump is the first U.S. president to ever sit a criminal trial. So I'm going to throw it to you, Bill. The question that I've been thinking about this week related to this is, will this trial matter come election day? So in whatever 6 months, is this going to matter?
This is a great question. Right? I think we've been thinking about this all week, and I think I have an answer that's yes, and I have an answer that's no. But maybe let's start a little bit with the trial itself. So this is, of all the trials that Trump is facing, and there are a couple federal ones dealing with January 6th. There's the document case that's down in Florida. There's the case in Atlanta that's relating to the 2020 election. Now this one is relating to hush money, right? So again, it can be very confusing with Trump's legal minefield that he's facing, but this one is about hush money that he paid to Stormy Daniels, the adult actress, to basically keep her quiet, right? So here's, what was it, like $160,000? I can't even remember the amount anymore. Yeah. Something like that. Here's some
you
money.
You pay that sort of hush money all the time, right, Bill?
Right. A professor has like huge hush money funds. So, right, so we're going to pay you this money so that you don't talk about this during the 2016 campaign. And by preventing that story from getting out, it impacted the election, right? So they're talking about both the business side of it, the illegality of paying hush money, but then also as it connects to the election, to say this had an impact on the election, you know, in terms of it was essentially a campaign, you know, moneymaker.
Contribution. Yeah.
That's the right word. That's what I was looking for. So will it matter? There's part of me that says no, right? And we were sharing some data this week. You had found some polling that said only a third think Trump is guilty, right? You know, so the data on that is really interesting that, you know, on the other cases, so the documents case, the January 6th case, those who think Trump is guilty is much higher. It's like closer to 50%. Mm-hmm. It mirrors maybe the partisan divide of the United States. But for this hush money case, it's only a third. I mean, I'll throw it back to you. I found that really shocking that, you know, it used to be a time in our politics where if there was this sort of scandal, that would be devastating. And here we're saying like a third of the public's like, hush money, you know, adult film stars, nothing to see here. What do you make of that data?
Well, so I think that says more about the charge than it does about Trump, right? And I think that's because, like, if you think about the things, like, you've mishandled classified documents. That's an easy to understand thing, right? You tried to overturn an election. That's an easy to understand thing. You tried to essentially bribe or pressure public officials in Georgia. That's something that, like, I can see where that's illegal. This is one of those where I think what he did is illegal, but it's like a, you know, it's like an, a, you know, an accounting crime type thing or whatever. So it's not a crime that is familiar to people. And so I think the one third don't think he did anything illegal, or only one third think he did anything illegal, says less about his behavior and more about, like, people are just are unaware. And I think that's where, as this trial plays out, like, it's been the center of the news, you know, just for the last, you know, couple of days. But as this trial plays out over the next few weeks, people will have a better understanding of what the crime is and why, you know, whether or not it's clear that Donald Trump committed this crime. And I think that number, therefore, will go up. It's just, I think it's just this trial hasn't gotten the attention, and it's a more obscure law that we're talking about. And so I think that's my speculation about what's at play here. Back around to it, the other part of it is that even though only a third of the people of Americans think he did anything illegal, when you push a little further, the number of people who say that if he's convicted, it will make him essentially, how did they, what was the, basically that,
make
that
him unfit he's for not, office.
Yeah. Unfit, thank you. Yeah. That he's unfit for office is, it's like over 50% of Americans who say, so even though only a third of people think he did anything illegal, they're basically, what that indicates to me is that they're open they're still open to the trial. It's basically them saying, I don't really understand what this case is about, but if he's convicted, if a jury finds him guilty of violating this crime, then he can't be a president. And that, I think that's significant. Brings me around to the fact that this trial will matter come election time, even if it's hard to kind of figure out exactly how right now.
Well, I think that's a great point, because the indictments of Donald Trump actually helped him politically, right? So we can go back to some of those first indictments. It really sort of saved his campaign, which is, there's a deep irony there. But I'm not sure if a conviction has the same effect, because you're right. The polling data suggests that, you know, half of the country says he's unfit if he's found guilty, even if we don't think he's, you know, it's that big of a trial. And it's especially among Republicans, where you see 15-20% of Republicans say, well, I support him, but if he's convicted of a crime, we can't have somebody. I mean, it's sort of weird how the American public thinks about all this. Like, I don't think it's that big of a deal, but if he's found guilty, I don't want a president who's, you know, guilty of federal charges or whatever that might be. So, and if we're talking about a tight election, that could matter quite a bit, especially if this then transitions to, if it is possible, not that second trial, the 2020 election, the January 6th one, the federal one, that big one, also happens before the election itself, right? Those two events could really be devastating for his political chances.
Yeah, this comes back to what we've talked about on previous weeks, which is, and I think you can even see this playing out already. You know, a number of weeks ago, we talked about whether it was time to panic because Trump was leading Biden, and like, more people trusted Trump than Biden, and the polls had Biden way behind. Even already this week, they've pulled even. So now Biden and Trump are polling sort of evenly. And that's been a fairly short period of time. And what we're going to have over the coming weeks and months is, first of all, on this trial standpoint, this is going to be in the news. And this is one of the things I come back around to. One of the things we know is that the more times you tell someone something, whether it's true or not, the more they believe it, right? And we can talk about that in terms of Trump's rhetoric. But in this case, the more exposed people are to the idea of Trump on trial and being convicted and whatnot, the more likely that's going to, again, adjust their ideas and impressions of whether this is a big deal or not. So we're going to have all of this. We're going to hear testimony from people that are going to lay out in detail sort of exactly what happened and why it's problematic. And then at the end, if he's convicted, it's not just that he's convicted. If he's convicted, he faces potentially up to 4 years in prison. And again, there's people out there who think, I'll vote for Donald Trump, but when they see him hauled away in cuffs to prison, I'm not saying that will happen, but if that happens, then that's going to have an impact. And so I think, even if it doesn't feel significant now, it will. And the other part is, just this is an example of, even if it's not the trial, what this is showing is, that there's going to be far more Donald Trump exposure in the coming months. And I think the more people are exposed to Donald Trump, whether it's on trial or whether it's press conferences or whatever, they're going to be reminded of who he is in a way that will take them back to the same reason he lost the last election. And so I still come around to that to some extent. But what, any, do you have thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, well, and I think if we add on, so the, one of the articles you sent me this week talked about that the percentage of the electorate, which is sort of undecided, because we talk about, like, it feels like the whole country is already decided and they're in camps. Yep. But the data suggests that there's a fair amount of the public that is open to changing their vote, that is open to both candidates, and that there is space for movement. And so, as you said, with the, as this trial plays out and as that information and just the reality of Trump being painted as a criminal over the next couple of months, like that is a, could have some impact seeping in. And the other thing that we talked about, I think what both and I, you and I found really fascinating, is that there's actually quite a bit of movement in the electorate that's happening in terms of where voters are shifting and happening, both some that help Trump, some that hurts Trump. And I think that's really interesting because we assume everything is hardened. But you sent some data this week talking about the shift and where Biden is struggling. And I'll let, maybe you can talk about the data more specifically, but that Biden is struggling with young voters, Latino voters, that they're starting to shift away, some independent voters, but he's doing better with older white men. You want to kind of walk us through some of that data?
Yeah. So I'll put this poll I'll put up on the website. But yeah, some stuff that's really interesting, which is like college educated white voters. In 2020, Biden had a 3-point advantage over Trump. And right now he's polling with a 24-point advantage. So there's been a 20 percentage point
huge
swing
shift
in Biden's favor among white educated, college educated voters. Men, it's an even bigger shift. So college educated white men in 2020 voted for Trump by 3%, and they're polling for Biden by 21%. I mean, those are massive,
huge,
massive shifts. So in this notion that we talk about how voters don't change their minds, there's at least some evidence. Now, again, this is polling. This isn't actual voting. So we'll see. It shouldn't be surprising that Biden has widened his lead dramatically with college educated white women as well. Some of the ones that were interesting to me is that I think what people think, you know, it's the over 45 crowd, the older crowd, has went for Trump by 3. They're polling for Biden by 6 now, so a 10 point swing. That's a group that I think of as being pro-Trump, right? An older American crowd. But, you know, independents have swung broadly towards Trump, and non-whites have swung from plus 45 Biden to plus 11 Biden. That's a 34 point swing. So you're exactly right. It is young people. Under 45 has swung towards Trump. So I threw a lot of numbers out there, but you're exactly right. It all indicates the electorate, educated and older people, are going towards Biden, all at the time that essentially minorities and young people are going towards Trump, which is so, like, it is so opposite of what I would expect. It's really fascinating.
And this news, it's mixed news. Right? I think either candidate can look at this and say it's good for them, right? So Biden can say, hey, we're doing better among older populations, we're doing better among white college-educated men, and there are a lot of them out there, right? So that really helps. I think Trump would be really excited about the movement in non-white Latino voters, right? Up 34. That's stunning. Independents and young people. Now, the question I would have, and the way we can circle back and think about the trials, can Biden pull that group back in? So as we're thinking about independents and we're thinking about young voters, as these trials play out, as we learn more about Trump, as Trump reemerges more into the center of all of our attention, do these young independent voters look at Trump and say, oh no, I was sort of tired of Biden, but when I look at Trump, I better vote for Biden? Or do they just stay home? I mean, I think there's a lot of ways this could play out, and it will have a dramatic impact on who ultimately wins the presidency. But in general, I think this data is probably on balance much better for Biden than it is for Trump in terms of the long-term security of it. But it does suggest that there may be a seismic shift occurring in the voter electorate for the United States.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going on, you know, turnout, old white people vote way more than young people do.
Yes.
Right. And so that's a good thing. But the other part of it, I think, that's important is that there's been lots of reporting this week on what are called double haters. Right.
Oh,
and so I think
that's
a lot of young people. When I think of my students, that's my students. When I talk to people like neighbors, this is what a lot of people have, which is essentially, I don't like either of these candidates. And the research shows that this was very much the case in the last two elections. But 4 years ago, they swung for Biden, people who were like, I don't like Trump or Biden. And 4 years prior to that, they swung for Trump. So those people who were like, I don't like Clinton and I don't like Trump went for Trump. And so I think you probably have some of that in this data. And I think there's a lot of young people who are sort of double haters. But in the end, in some ways, they're the ones who will decide the outcome of this election. And research, you know, history says they have swung for Biden in the past. And I think that would bode well for him as well. Again, and I think that's another one where the more people are exposed to, people have been exposed to Biden for 4 years. Yeah. The more people are again exposed to Trump, I think that makes it, you know, if you're choosing on the lesser of two evils, there's going to be more people who are like, all right, I didn't like Biden, but I remember what that other guy's like. So
that category of double haters is really fascinating. Yeah. I think it connects back to our first topic, depending on how the Israel-Gaza conflict plays out. If that is still occurring in November, I think it's bad news for Biden. I think he has to find a way to start moving that in a more positive direction, especially for young people. But I think you're right. On balance, there are more pitfalls ahead for Trump than there are for Biden. It's like some of the negativity for Biden is already worked in, and I think Trump has more work to do.
Yep.
This is fat. All right. Well, should we wrap up there on the double haters?
I think so. I think that's a good place to wrap up. And if you want to learn a little bit more about either of these topics, you can go to thepoliticslab.com. And I've got a few articles up there about both. Several interesting articles from The Atlantic and from Dan Dresner on the Iran stuff. And then I'll throw some of this polling data that Bill and I were just talking about up on the other one. So you can find all that at thepoliticslab.com. Click on this week's episode.
That's fantastic. All right. I'll see you next week, Phil.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.